Why are you making a film? It is to see what people think and to have a communal experience once that film is foisted upon the public.
Cinephile, the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast.
Listen, I would love to say we are a well-oiled machine here on Cinephile, but listen, it's a work in progress. It's organic. Organic, one of these big buzzwords, by the way, which I think I despise. I used to say it was okay. Now I'm like, no, I don't like organic food. I don't like organic processes or processes, as I would say. So speaking of organic, that open there, I don't even know what I'm saying. This is episode 5, and it's like, oh, it's a communal experience. It's so foisted upon it. I don't think that I'm particularly highfalutin. I really don't. I don't think that I'm preachy or self-indulgent. When I hear that quote, I go, God, how annoying is that guy? Who would want to listen to this podcast? It's a communal experience. Get out of here, Virk. I just want to go watch a nice popcorn movie.
Are you saying we should change the open?
Yeah, it's going to be changed for next time. But for episode 5 of Cinephile, I'm Adnan Virk. It's great to have you with us. That is my man, Dan Stanzik. Somebody tweeted, they go, hey, what's with the Stanzik guy? And I go, let's make this very clear. Without Stanzik doing this, there is no Cinephile. So I will take zero criticism of my guy. The guy said Stanzik, he goes, well, I don't like his opinions. What is he, like 25? I go, he's 30. He's wise beyond his years. And once again, he's doing this free. So if he says, you know what, I'm tired of this backlash against Stanzik, he's out.
Screw that guy.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. We got lots coming up today, including Dennis Leary. He was very funny, very entertaining. He's got the best Titanic story you're ever going to hear. I was a huge fan of Rescue Me. He talks about that wonderful show and Michael J. Fox's appearances on that show. He also gets into Wag the Dog, which is an underrated movie, which is very much ahead of its time. All that coming up. Plus, we'll do our usual three words. Got some good ones today. Actors Showcase Jack Nicholson. We're going with the Legends division. I like this out of Stanzik. Plus, a Scorsese story as well. So let's get it going here first off with new movies out of the gate. The Phenom. My man, Paul Giamatti and Ethan Hawke, Johnny Simmons is the cast for this one. And it's, I think, one of the best movies of this summer. Now, granted, I think this summer's been a little bit disappointing so far. But The Phenom is all that it is cracked up to be. The story is quite straightforward. It's about a baseball pitcher named Johnny Simmons is the actor playing him. Throws 100 miles an hour, and he's a phenom. Absolute stud. But he's crumbling under the pressure right now, emotionally and psychologically, coming from those around him. And that is his father, Ethan Hawke, who is totally channeling De Niro in This Boy's Life. Or if you listen to this podcast, Will Arnett had a great Santini reference, which is Robert Duvall playing a military domineering father. Either of those options work. Just go back and watch De Niro in This Boy's Life or Duvall in The Great Santini. And I think Ethan Hawke used those as prep because he's that guy. He said that I read an interview and Hawke said I knew how to play this guy because I knew someone like this growing up. A buddy of mine was a great athlete and his dad was just like this. He goes, even the hair, I knew to go with the brush cut and the tattoos and the jean shorts and the shirt open. He goes, like, pure redneck. And the beauty of Ethan Hawke's performance is that you can play this guy as a real stereotype, this vile, emotionally abusive father, physically abusive as well, and just go, all right, he's a stereotype and that's it. But Hawke plays him, and listen, he's obviously a horrible guy and unrepentant, but he shows that he's not just being a jerk to his son, he actually believes this is the way to succeed. There's one scene where Simmons is at an empty ballpark and Hawke happens to show up and he goes, listen, I saw your body language the other day, it just wasn't good. Like, think about Dave Stewart. Think about Roger Clemens. Think about Bob Gibson. Like, those guys, they already had won the game when they stepped on the mound because it was all about intimidation and that glare. And so he's trying to instill in his son this type of competitive spirit and this zeal for winning. And yet, obviously, his method is horrible because his kid is struggling. And it's not that he's overly sensitive. It's not that today's generation is getting babied. It's the fact that his dad's a world-class jerk. And when you've got this kind of pressure on yourself, it's incredibly tough to overcome. And there's one scene Johnny Simmons is talking to his girlfriend. He just goes, do you have any idea how much pressure I'm under? And, like, you can tell she has no idea. She's like, okay, you're a great pitcher. You can throw a ball 100 miles an hour. And he's like, do you know, like, what I'm going through every time I go out on the mound between scouts and my dad? And his mom's in the picture, but she's you only see her briefly. I mean, she seems like a loving mom, but not strong enough to stand up to the father. So that's obviously not helping out the kid. So enter Paul Giamatti. He plays a psychiatrist very kindly. Giamatti's on a run here of psychiatrists slash managers. If you'll recall, he was the manager in Straight Outta Compton, who ended up being a bad guy because he's stealing money from all these guys. He was a psychiatrist in Love and Mercy, the Brian Wilson biopic, which I really enjoyed, with Paul Dano playing Brian Wilson as a kid, and then John Cusack played Brian Wilson as an elder person. Again, Giamatti was an evil shrink. This time I'm happy to say he's a shrink, but he's actually a kind one and supportive and he really is trying to deal with exercises and empathy. When he's sitting there with Johnny Simmons, they're watching baseball together, and Simmons is naturally skeptical. He's like, what are we doing here? Like, we're watching tape? Like, you're my pitching coach? And he's like, no, I just want to know, like, what are you thinking here? You know, what's going through your mind here? And I think that this happens a lot more, I think, in pro sports than people realize. A lot of teams employ sports psychologists, especially when a guy's struggling. Like, you think famously when Knobloch or Steve Sachs before that couldn't make throws to first base. Mackie Sasser, the catcher, couldn't throw the ball back to the pitcher's mound. Like, there's weird stuff that happens, particularly, I feel like, in baseball. And that's where they have these guys. And Giamatti's backstory isn't just that he's a kind psychiatrist. He's got some skeletons in his past as well. So it's a really absorbing film, a very atypical baseball movie. I'm going to say maybe 5 minutes of baseball action. Maybe. Tops. Not even. I think, like, you see him on the rubber, you see him practicing, but, like, actual game action, maybe a minute. Like, there's not much. It's all about what happens behind the scenes. 85 minutes. You know, I love short movies, so there's another reason to go watch it. Maybe tough to find in your local theater. I don't know where it's playing here in the Northeast, but it's on DirecTV, which I find is a really good outlet now to watch a lot of movies that don't have wide release. You just $8, you watch on DirecTV. So The Phenom, excellent movie. Stanzik, I hope that you watch it. Hopefully we can get a screener at some point. Do you have DirecTV? Is this an option in the Stanzik?
I was just going to say, you're like, it's really easy on DirecTV if you have DirecTV. If you don't, then where are you going to see it?
Yeah, because it's one of these movies. It's definitely one of these New York, L.A. It's in the major markets. If you're in Nebraska right now, shout out to Omaha if you're listening. Make the drive to go watch The Phenom. Just go ahead and
take the theater in Iowa that you went to.
Yeah, exactly. Iowa. Shout out to Iowa. $5.23 to go see Free State of Jones, which is the next movie I'm reviewing. The movies are $5 before noon on a Saturday. That is unheard of. I walked in. She goes, 5:23. And I'm like, is it 1985? Like, what time warp did I just walk into? Like, where am I right now? Sadly, the film was worth about $5.23. And that's in today's money because it was very disappointing. As I tweeted, it is a ponderous slog. Matthew McConaughey is drenched in sweat and nobility. You go into one of those movies, Stanzik, and you see the trailer, and you just go, okay, I got it. There's going to be lengthy speechifying. It's going to be awfully leaden. It's banal subject matter. And it's a story that if you read the book and you're a bibliophile, you're going to go, this is a rousing story. This was a guy who had an uprising in Mississippi, a Confederate soldier, ended up leading a slave revolt, very important character, ended up having a white wife and then a black wife as well, fathered kids from both sides. Oh, very interesting story. And the movie, you go, none of the conflicts are going to be there. It's going to be very simple, very black and white. And that's exactly what this movie is.
Then why do you go see it? If I see an awful trailer, I'm like, I'm never going
to
see that.
We've got a podcast. I'm trying to watch new movies, get people into this thing. To be perfectly frank, plus I was in Omaha, Nebraska. There wasn't a whole lot going on. They don't have the indie movies like The Phenom playing there, which is why I had to go see Free State of Jones. Trust me, no podcast, and I'm not in Omaha. There's no way I'm seeing Free State of Jones. But we had some time to kill.
We're still waiting on Maple Leafs for both of those.
So The Phenom, I'm going to give 4 Maple Leafs. We go 4 to 4 Maple Leafs just because of the fact, like I said, it's a unique sports film and the acting is so great. All three of them. I'm obviously giving love to Giamatti and Ethan Hawke.
Well, with him, games, with Giamatti in a film, that's a guaranteed 3 Maple Leafs, right?
No, somebody tweeted that. He goes, that guaranteed 1.5. 3 sounds excessive. Probably guaranteed 2. So just the fact he's in the movie. So, like, I'm like, all right, Giamatti's in it? Great. 2 stars right away. Oh, well, as soon as you just see the name in the credits, I'm like, oh, yeah, I love this film. It's already rousing me. It's already getting my embers flowing. So 2 automatically for Giamatti, who we're going to get on Cinephile at some point. Josh Drew, our talent booker, is fighting valiantly here to make it happen. He's in production, I believe, season 2 of Billions. So in the fall, we're going to try to get Giamatti. And I'll ask him, I'll go, hey, what do you think about the fact I give you 2 Maple Leafs right out of the gate? How good does that make you feel? 4 Maple Leafs for The Phenom, 1.5 for Free State of Jones. Now, you're going to be upset here, Stanzik. Continuing this theme of why do I see these movies, again, I was in Omaha, didn't have much to do, and we have a podcast. People like hearing new releases. Went and saw The Shallows. Blake Lively's shark film.
I'll tell you what, that's a reason to go see a movie right there, though. Blake Lively.
And let's be honest. I understand our target audience. From all the tweets that I get, it looks like you're 95% male. You're all about 18 to 34. So you know what? For this demographic, go out and go see The Shallows. Because you know what? Blake Lively is a surfer girl in her bathing suit for 90 minutes, 95 minutes. Go ahead. Hey, it's summer, man. Have a good time. She looks great. And the shark's pretty good, too. I mean, listen, this is a shark film. We're not looking for a complex narrative. We're not looking for anything too strenuous. This is Blake Lively in a bathing suit. Oh, my God, there's a shark. What am I going to do to get out of this thing? Flare guns. We've got some decent cinematography. A rather bizarre cameo from this guy. I don't want to, give away secrets. But listen, it's no Jaws. But I thought for what it was, a shark film, a genre movie, Blake Lively, I'll give it 3 Maple Leafs. Right? That's staggering to you. Think about this. I gave the Michael Moore film 2.5, Where to Invade Next, which is provocative and smart, and I'm penalizing him because it's not as good as his other work. And I just gave The Shallows with Blake Lively, which is a shark movie, 3 Maple Leafs.
I think your standards in this summer heat have dipped considerably.
You think I'm being too generous here?
I haven't seen the film. I have no intentions to see the film. Yes. 3 out of 4.
That's staggering. Maybe I just really like shark movies.
And she is that hot.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe that's all that this comes down to. The last movie that I'll be reviewing is called Doc and Daryl. Thanks to those here at ESPN Films for passing it along to me. It is the story of Dwight Gooden and Daryl Strawberry. It's the latest 30 for 30. It is premiering Wednesday, June 14th at 9 o'clock Eastern. Judd Apatow, the great comedic director, is actually the co-director of this film, which may lend the fact why you get some celebrity cameos in here. Jon Stewart is featured prominently. I know he's a huge Mets fan. Bill Maher makes an appearance. I'm assuming Apatow reached out to these guys.
Did you notice Bill Maher, it says he's a part owner of the Mets?
Yeah.
Did you know that?
I was going to say, all you ever hear about is the Wilpons and how broke the Mets are. I'm like, Bill Maher should be chipping in here. Real time with Bill Maher. He loves the Mets. Who knew he was that big a fan? Stanzik has also seen the film, as you can tell by the fact he jumped in there. I encourage him to watch it as a baseball fan and certainly somebody who can appreciate what Doc and Daryl. A little young for you. I mean, it was in the 80s, really. But you obviously were aware of their reputations by the time you started following
them. I mean, I would, for younger listeners, I would say they are the Strasburg and Bryce Harper of the 80s, but with playoff success.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate comparison because both those guys highly touted. I mean, I remember Gooden. I was born in 78, so 85 when he had that 1.53 ERA. And he was just, I mean, 84 was a great rookie of the year season, 17-8, like a high 2.8 ERA, something like 2.84, I want to say. 85, though, he was just ridiculous, like 25-3, and it was like, oh, my God, this guy's like Gibson in 68. And then 86, when they won the World Series, he actually wasn't as good. He was still very good, but they say in the doc, even Keith Hernandez says, he goes, well, he wasn't as great as he'd been, like, superhuman the first 2 years. And then the World Series, actually, he was disappointing. He actually matched up with Clemens in game 2, and the Red Sox won that game because they went up 2-0 in the series. And then Doc again got roughed up in game 5. And that, you know, the film obviously explains Gooden up to that point, but then really details his decline. The fact he missed the World Series parade, and he was really dipping hard into cocaine and heavy drinking. And he makes no apologies. And the best thing about the film is it's really honest and unadulterated when it comes to what these guys went through. And unlike a great film like O.J. Made in America, also ESPN Films, 30 for 30, you know, you have these guys giving their first-person account. As great as the O.J. documentary was, and I highly recommend it, 5 parts, all 9 hours. Obviously, you don't have a lot of O.J. in his own words, certainly not now reflecting on what he's done because he's in the Big House. You've got Strawberry telling his story. You've got Doc Gooden telling their stories. And Gooden's, and both those guys have always been incredibly honest. I mean, if you want to criticize them for throwing away their careers and unfortunately letting drug abuse and alcohol abuse overwhelm them, I suppose that's your right if you're a moralist. But I'm of the type to say, listen, these guys face the demons. They are very honest with what they've done. They've tried being drug counselors and rehabilitation and trying others. And I don't know how you can't have at least sympathy for what they've gone through. But Gooden, yeah, once he started dipping in the nose candy, then he got an off-the-field issue in Tampa. You see his downfall. Strawberry was a guy, long and lean. They said, just like Ted Williams, they say that. I mean, how does that – think of the phenom now, the other film I reviewed, a young star with hype. Someone starts telling you you're the next Ted Williams. How does that not affect your psyche a little bit? You're going to think all of a sudden you're going to hit 500 home runs and be the greatest hitter who ever lived. And Strawberry would hit tape measure shots. Like, he was awesome for the Mets when they called him up. But again, unfortunately, drugs and alcohol abuse undermined Straw. And he did have – both those guys had interesting second acts. So remember, Strawberry went to the Dodgers and was productive, but you know, never matched the Ruthian heights he should have been. He should have been a Hall of Famer, no doubt about it. Never was. But did get a second chance, or even a third chance, I guess you could say, with the Yankees and George Steinbrenner. He talks about how George was very kind to him and benevolent, and he was always appreciative of that. You know, he had overcame cancer and all those other drug issues which were prior to that. Doc Gooden ended up going to the Yankees as well, pitching a no-hitter, so he had one great moment late in his career. But again, never matched up to what it should have been. Makes me think of the Bronx Tale, A Bronx Tale, the Chaz Palminteri De Niro movie where he says there's nothing so bad in life as wasted potential. And that's exactly what these two guys are all about. So Doc and Daryl, I'll give it 3.5 Maple Leafs. Clearly, if you're a baseball fan, especially of the 80s, you'll really like this movie. But it's great the fact that they actually meet at a diner. They share stories again. They reconcile a little bit. So I enjoyed it. Stancic, how about you?
I enjoyed it as well. I was just going to say at the tail end there, it has a the subject matter is obviously not comedic, but it has a very comedians in cars getting coffee type feel the way it's shot.
Nice. That's a good call, especially the fact you're right. They're meeting in a coffee shop, and it's very casual and very less.
You're seeing there, like, the checks and coffee getting poured and pies getting cut.
By the way, have you watched the new season of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee? Apparently John Oliver's on it. I cannot wait. I don't even know why we're doing this right now. We should stop taping this. Go watch John Oliver, if it's available right now, on Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. I love that show. Picked up Seinfeld, new book called Seinfeldia. Just hit bookstores yesterday. Behind-the-scenes stories of Seinfeld, 270 pages. I got a flight to Cali. That is an easy read. But as far as the latest films, once again, The Phenom, 4 Maple Leafs, Free State of Jones, 1.5 Maple Leafs, The Shallows, a generous 3 Maple Leafs, and Doc and Daryl coming out Wednesday, July 14th, 9 o'clock Eastern on ESPN. The latest 30 for 30, Doc and Daryl gets 3.5 Maple Leafs. What a blast to be joined by Dennis Leary here on Cinephile, the Adnan Virk movie podcast. The beauty, Dennis, because you're doing the car wash today here at ESPN, you're talking to Mike and Mike and Rossillo and Connelly's different shows, a little more tame. Here we can see the Dennis Leary that we all know and love. So you can just let it fly here, just so you know.
Well, I'd like to say that Mike Greeny is an not watching any of my – he invites me on his show, right? You know, Mike in the morning. By the way, I'm a sports nut.
Of course, you're a huge hockey fan.
I have to do Howard Stern baseball on like Wednesday, and Howard doesn't understand. Like, I don't listen. My kids and my wife, right, they're Howard Stern fanatics. I don't listen to Howard Stern or anything else. I listen to Mike in the morning and Sports Center Radio.
Right.
Because first of all, I flip between those two and like an NHL Network or baseball. You know what I mean? I'm getting my sports information.
Totally.
Especially if I'm driving.
Right.
So. You know, he was the one who called me and said, you got to come back on the show. And I'm like, okay, great. And while I was on the show,
He's a big fan of sex, drugs, and
rock and roll. Yeah, so he mentioned sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I go, so what do you think so far of the season? And he's like, I haven't seen any of it. I said, what about last year? He's like, I haven't seen the show. I'm like, dude,
I was going to say, if you're not up on season two, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. So,
because I did this with Rescue Me. I'm originally from Toronto, so we used to get Rescue Me on Showcase. It was a little bit behind the FX season.
Oh, okay.
So I'd always get worried. I couldn't read Entertainment Weekly or Premiere. I'm like, oh, I can't get spoilers. So the first ever episode I saw of Rescue Me was an incredible episode. It was the last episode of season two where your son gets hit by the car.
Yeah.
And then Amanda Roth, fellow Canadian, slaps you in that scene. I'm like, oh, my God, this is Dennis Leary I've never seen. It was incredibly powerful, that entire episode. I'm like, I got to go back and watch all this. And the beauty of Rescue Me is this. You have your persona and who you are, which is a really funny, angry guy, and you've always utilized that. But to me, Rescue Me was great acting, period. Like, the drama that you had in that show, and obviously based in reality, and the appreciation, respect that you had for firefighters, which you can feel throughout that episode, the fact it was so timely, the fact it was after 9/11. Like, I was always happy you'd get nominated for the Emmy, but it still bothers me. You and Peter Tolan never actually broke through and won for one of those.
Well, Peter won.
For writing, didn't he?
He went twice for
Larry Sanders, Shandling,
and Murphy Brown, right?
That's right.
So, Peter's got two.
Right.
Yeah, we got nominated. We were.
You'd get nominated every year for Best
Actor. We went 1 for 10. The only guy who won an Emmy.
Michael J. Fox.
And even our DP got nominated for, you know, DP awards and never won. I got nominated for all these Golden Globes. And the only guy that won a Golden Globe or an Emmy for our show is Michael J. Fox. Now, listen.
He was hilarious, by the way.
I know.
You haven't seen the Michael J. Fox Rescue Me episodes. He was great on Curb Your Enthusiasm, too, and obviously you're friends with him, but that's what's great about Michael J. Fox. He takes this whole Parkinson's thing and completely subverts it.
Yeah.
I don't want any sympathy. I don't want any...
Dude, by the way,
role he played on your show was
hilarious.
I have
to tell you that we...
He was an...
Yeah, we wrote that role. I didn't have to convince him, but I said, listen, dude, it is a challenge because you're basically a guy who's paralyzed. You're still, you know, you're in a wheelchair and you have to be very still.
Right.
But also he's an... I told Mike, I said, listen, dude, here's the thing, because Rescue Me and the same thing on Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, like...
Right.
You know, when we write them, we're like, listen, here's the things that have to stay. But you can, for the actors, you can get away with whatever you want. You can improvise your way around. And the actors always make it better.
Right.
So I told Michael, take the elements of the story and you can improvise. And he was attracted to that idea. Yeah. I said, you can improvise as the dark side of this character, which is, you know, really kind of mean, pissed off, bitter guy. Mm-hmm. And also on the comedy side. So a lot of the stuff that ended up being so great about that part was stuff that Mike brought to it. The first day that Mike shot on Rescue Me, none of the guys in the crew had worked with Mike on my crew on Rescue Me. And Mike came in, and I've known Mike for a long time. So I know, you know, as much as you can know about Mike.
Right.
And
he's a huge hockey fan. You play hockey, all that stuff.
He's a really funny guy. He's got a very dark sense of humor, and he's incredibly smart. And he's also a great dramatic actor, which people forget. Right? People forget
that. To my grave, I say Casualties of War.
Casualties of War, okay?
Right.
So he came in, and his first speech was a big dramatic speech in a bar, at the end of which he slams down this shot glass, and he scares the shit. He's talking about what happened to him and why he's paralyzed.
Right.
And at the end of that scene, I mean, it's just straight drama.
Yeah.
And I said, you want to shoot your side first? And he said, yes. We shot Mike's side first. And he said, just shoot me two cameras at the same time because I want to be able to pour myself into this and not have to do it more than once, you know? Yeah. And he went into that. He came into the set and everybody's like, hey, Mike. And they're all meeting him. You know, a couple guys take pictures with him and he's Mike, you know?
Right.
Funny. And he sat down and we set action and he did that scene. I'm telling you, as an actor on the other side of the scene with him, I was sitting across the table. Two things went through my mind. One, he's nailing the out of this. Number two, this scene's going to get stolen from me because Mike is so good, right?
Right?
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
When he slammed the thing down, he actually kind of scared me. And then he slammed his fist down on the table.
Right.
They called cut. The way the crew, the makeup people, they looked at Mike completely differently because he was in such a foul mood from doing the monologue.
Right.
And he went outside to smoke a cigarette and just kind of calmed down. And everybody was like, well, he's really good. And I'm like, yeah, he's a little scary. You know what I mean? He's a little scary.
He was amazing. I love the fact that he was nominated one. And hearing that story, you can see a guy like him, how he'd be so into it. But again, you're giving a lot of respect to him. I know Michael J. Fox is a great actor, but I think a lot of that was Rescue Me because I think it's, like I said, it was not only a time capsule, Dennis, but all those great shows we started to see on cable, right? The Sopranos and Breaking Bad.
Listen,
so like, Rescue Me was I'm telling you, it was a forerunner to a lot of that.
I know.
Anti-hero.
But listen, if you're going to paint the picture, and I'll tell you, I mean, I remember it exactly because I knew Gandolfini.
Right.
And I remember I was doing a show called The Job.
Peter Tolman as well.
Yeah, ABC, which they canceled, thank God, because that's what led to Rescue Me. But
it was an underrated show.
It was a good show.
I thought it was funny.
They just didn't know what to make of it. But anyways, when that show was happening, Ted Demme was an old friend of mine.
The ref.
He said, hey, listen, man, have you heard about this thing that they're thinking of doing over at HBO? That Gandolfini's the star. Gandolfini's a terrific actor, by the way.
Right.
At that point, he was just a character actor. Not a lot of people knew who he was.
Get Shorty, some other stuff.
Yeah, he was terrific.
Yeah.
And he goes, they're doing a mob family drama with Gandolfini playing the head guy. And now my first reaction was, wow, he's going to kill that role. That would be a fantastic role for him. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't Tony Soprano. If you saw him in other roles,
yeah,
he was a very sweet, sort of a gentle big bear of a guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that would be a great part for him.
Right.
So by the time the job got canceled, so now you're talking like, it was after 9/11. So it was 2002, that winter when we got canceled. Beginning of 2002. By then, The Sopranos had taken off.
Right.
And everybody, and The Shield came on FX,
if you remember,
right?
Right.
And so The Shield established, The Shield was from John Landgraf and the guys at FX, and they were establishing kind of a beachhead, like, it's not just HBO anymore, you can do it some other places. So The Shield, I don't know if you watched that show.
I did, it was very intense.
Okay, so Vic Mackey, that character.
Right.
Just unbelievable.
But this is the thing. Because your guy in Rescue Me was a noble character who's fighting demons, and I love the theme of how he's, you know, haunted by ghosts and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Vic Mackey's just an amoral bastard.
Yeah. But did you watch the whole series?
No. You know what? I thought it started to lose its way a little bit towards the end.
Because it has one of the greatest endings.
Well, that's what everyone says to me. They go
all time.
If all the people get pissed about the Sopranos finale, they go, the Shield finale might be as good as it gets as far as shows elevating.
When you watch the end of The Shield, you go, like, I remember looking at it and going, oh, my God, how'd they think of that? That would be the last thing I would ever think of, and it's the perfect ending. And by the way, I love The Sopranos so much. It's my favorite television show of all time.
Amazing.
Gandolfini was extraordinary. So was Edie Falco. A lot of people on that
Michael
show.
Imperioli.
Ugh. So I didn't care about the ending because I loved the show so much. That show, I had to watch that show. I couldn't even do it on tape. I had to watch every Sunday night at 9 o'clock.
Right.
Like it was live TV. And my friends would go like, dude, what are you doing? I'm like, I feel like The Sopranos happen at 9 o'clock on Sunday nights. That's what I'm watching.
Event TV.
Yeah.
Initial thought when you first, weren't you mad when it cut to black? Or did you just kind of go?
No. Here's what happened.
Give me a minute to process.
We were shooting Rescue Me.
Right.
So I had to go to work early the next morning. It was on a Sunday night, as you remember.
Yeah.
I was alone in my apartment. Saw the ending, saw cut to black, and I went.
My TV went out. My cable went out.
For a second, I was like, my and then I went, oh, no. I went, oh, cool. Go to bed.
Yeah.
Get up in the morning. I go to work, and my partner and a bunch of the other guys that work for us, they're all huge Soprano freaks, and I'm like, God, first thing in the morning, guys, how great was that ending? They're like, that ending sucked. It ruined the show. Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, all right, whatever. I was just so happy to have had the show.
Right.
And then Gandolfini you know, after that, he did a couple of things. There's a couple of movies.
Enough said with Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Oh, my God.
It was amazing.
And then there's the Drop with
Tom
Hardy. It's
yes.
Fantastic.
Right.
And he did a play called Gods of Carnage on Broadway where he was playing closer to the real Jim Gandolfini. He played this kind of guy. His wife has him sort of wrapped around her finger, and he's kind of a big, mousy guy.
Right.
And he's funny as hell, and he's very sensitive.
I remember they adapted it into a movie, and the movie apparently wasn't as good.
Polanski, he didn't do the movie.
Yeah, he didn't do it. Christoph Waltz.
They should have tried to get him for the movie. He was brilliant. He got nominated. I think he won the Tony for that. But
pretty sure, yeah.
When I went to see him in that, it made me start to hate him because I knew how great he was. But I was sitting in the audience the first night, and I was like, I kind of hate this guy. There's nothing he can't do. Like, he wasn't a song and dance guy.
No.
I know he won't be doing musicals, but
he
was so brilliant as an actor. I'm going, this is ridiculous.
Well, The Sopranos, I mean, you're right. You could do the range of emotion there. Because it's this guy who's trying to take care of his family, and yet he's trying to run this mafia family. He's got pain, which he needs to exercise with
But you know what? Him and them, because we're here to talk about my show.
No, you're I was about to say, this isn't nearly enough Dennis Leary conversation.
Yeah, I know. You know what? We should be talking about my show.
You're
now
very generous here as far as giving props to other guys.
Yeah.
We'll get into sex, drugs, and rock and roll in just a second. But I want to mention Wag the Dog, which is such an underrated movie.
Oh, my God.
That part of. Yeah. I think that's another movie that was predicting the future, the fact we're going into war under false pretenses.
Yeah.
How funny. Mamet wrote the script.
Yeah.
You're with De Niro, Dustin Hoffman. What was that experience like?
Well, it was great because I did another Mamet movie that was based on a play. One of his first plays, Lake Boat, and it was
George Wendt was in that one.
Yeah, it was a great cast. Peter Falk, myself, I'm going to forget guys.
J.J. Johnston,
all the great Mamet actors. Joe Mantegna directed it,
right?
And that we stuck to every word because Mamet and Joe backed him up. Mamet wanted the movie to be exactly the same words as the play, and that can be tough. Because it doesn't allow the actors to stretch a lot in terms of what they can bring to it. But I still loved the experience because Peter Falk was in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was a huge Columbo fan.
Right.
And I wanted to work with a lot of guys in that cast.
Mm-hmm.
But Falk was the main reason I went into it. And I had a scene where it was just me and Falk. It was fantastic.
Right.
Anyways, when I did Wag the Dog, Barry Levinson said, De Niro's partner was producing it. And they said, listen, we want to take a lot of the stuff that's in the script and keep it. We also want to have. We're going to shoot multiple cameras all the time, and we're going to improvise. So we're going to have. Oh, I think it was a week of rehearsal before we start shooting, where the main characters are just going to be in a room with Barry,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to improvise, and we're going to record it.
Right.
And then they would transcribe that. And as we were going through that process, you know, I'm with De Niro and Hoffman. Bob, I knew for a number of years before that, but I'd never met Dustin, and I'd never worked with either one of them. So I was a little intimidated. I'm Dustin's right-hand man, and Dustin was – every day he had like a different voice and then a different approach.
He was sending up Robert Evans was the story.
Well, it didn't start that way.
Okay.
It started with – it was weird. The first couple of days I was worried. I was like, yesterday he was doing a certain kind of thing, and now he's doing a whole different thing. And I'm supposed to be improvising with him as his right-hand man, and I couldn't get a key.
Yeah.
And at one point I went outside to smoke, and De Niro – was walking out with me, and I said, what's going on? And he went, I don't know. And I'm like, if you don't know. And then the next day, Dustin came in with the haircut and the glasses, and we all went, oh, he's doing Robert Evans.
Right. For those who know, Robert Evans, legendary Hollywood producer, 70s, the Godfather of Chinatown.
And from that moment on,
right.
It was, I'm telling you, I have to go back and watch the movie. I haven't seen it since it came out.
It's hysterical.
But you're
great in it because, again, I can feel like a lot of it's improvised.
Well, a lot of it's improvised, and they had two or three cameras going at a time. And I'm just telling you, when I first saw it, I went like, wow, there's whole chunks of that movie that were completely improvised.
Right.
Either before we did the scripted version or after the scripted version. Sometimes it was just – I can't describe it. It was like playing Major League Ball with Babe Ruth and Hank Aaron. Okay. I mean, like these guys are hitting – grand slams,
right?
And they're hitting. They want you to like set them up,
right?
You know, or catch the ball and throw it back to home plate. It was crazy every day, you know. It was terrific. And actually, it's funny how the movie has had so much resonance. It's still being played now because of the political situation. You know?
No doubt about it. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Right now, Dennis Leary's show. You do Rescue Me, which is
by the way, that's another movie we got nominated for a bunch of Oscars and Golden Globes. We didn't win anything.
So Mamet and Hillary Henkin, I think, called
they got
the
they got
nominated.
Nominated. Dustin got nominated.
Levinson, I think was.
I think our DP got nominated. And then we got nominated for a million things, and we won nothing. But I don't
care.
It
was 97.
So 97,
English Patient was 96. I can't remember off the head about what 97 was.
Something,
got robbed, either way, whatever it was.
Whatever.
Titanic, of course.
Who cares?
Stanza called the way. Yeah, who cares? What would you rather watch right now, Wag the Dog or Titanic?
I saw Titanic, and I fell asleep, right? Get this. So I go, I don't want to see the movie. My kids were small, and my kids were taking a nap. My wife's like, don't come home now. You're just going to wake them up. They'll get all excited. So I'm walking. I just bought a giant tuna sub on Broadway in New York. I'm like, oh, Titanic. The show's starting right now. Like, I don't want to see it, but what the hell? It'll kill 3 hours.
Right.
I go in. I eat the sub. Like the first 15 minutes of the movie. Fall asleep. Right? And I thought I didn't like the movie. It wasn't meant for me. In the beginning, I'm like, this is not meant for me. I fall asleep. I'm in the middle. It's sold out house. I'm in the middle of a row. It was the only seat left when I came in with the sub. They were already giving me dirty looks when I was walking in.
Right.
And while I was eating it, they were like, shh, shh. So I fall asleep. I wake up, and what's his name? DiCaprio is floating on a, you know, piece of ice.
Right. Iceberg.
And, yeah, iceberg. And I don't know why. It struck me as the funniest thing I'd ever seen. And I started laughing out loud, like the loudest thing. I didn't mean to. It was almost like I was at home.
Right.
And people went crazy. People were like, shh, shh. And I looked at everybody, men and women, are all crying. And I was like, that made me laugh harder. Right. So now I'm like, I got to leave. So I get up to leave and I'm like, excuse me. People are like, people were actually kicking me in the shins. And it's making me, I'm laughing my balls off. I get to the aisle and I walk outside. And when I get outside, I'm laughing so hard, I have to bend over and just like, I'm cackling. I'm almost puking. That's how hard I'm laughing. And I look up, and there's 200 people in line who are staring at me because they're going in to see Titanic, the next show. And I'm like, oh, it's hilarious.
James Cameron with the funniest movie of the year.
Oh, man. Appalling.
Speaking of hilarious, The Ref is a really underrated Christmas movie. I think that's a great companion piece with Bad Santa.
Yes.
You, Kevin Spacey. I think that's a cult classic, and I hope that you tell me that that's grown with, like, people talk about it with you, right? Because I don't think at the time people appreciated it.
Well, it's crazy. when we made it, we said, we're making the It's a Wonderful Life. So we're basically making a movie that very few people are going to want to see after we make it because it's so dark. But that audience that sees it will probably love it.
Yeah.
And now it's like 22 years. How many years ago?
The Ref was 94, yeah.
So it's 22 years ago, right?
Right.
And every single Christmas, it gets, you know.
Oh, yeah. It's
crazy. Crazy. It's all over. I've been in, like, other countries, and you're like, they show The Ref over here? Because it is the antithesis. It's funny how Bad Santa and The Ref became, like, they run them on cable networks all over the world at Christmas time because the other good networks, the nice networks, are running It's a Wonderful Life.
Right.
And maybe, you know, White Christmas.
Right, right. Bing Crosby, whatever you want. Yeah. Some nice, sweet
stuff.
So
I'm glad because I really loved making that movie, man. That was a blast.
Hilarious movie. Sex, Drugs, Rock and Roll. You got to check out Dennis Leary's show. As I said, I picked it up late, but again, I'm going to go back and see it in sequence. But the premise of it is this. So Dennis and his buddies, a rock and roll band. What I'm curious is this, because again, it has that mix of humor and drama, and you're bouncing your family, et cetera. But 80s and 90s bands, is there anyone that you, because I'm assuming you're a rock and roll guy, is there anybody that you were basing it off of or friends that you kind of lean on?
Yeah, it was based on.
And a musician.
I had a bunch of friends when I was a teenager. I went to Emerson College in Boston, which is a performing arts school. Mm. I was there for acting and writing. Yeah. And I had a bunch of friends who were, you know, musicians.
Right.
Really talented guys. And they were involved in one of the theater groups I was involved with, which was the Comedy Workshop up there, which is still there to this day.
Right.
And but gradually, because they were music guys, they started to leave school early because they got offers to be in bands.
Mm-hmm.
And because that Boston scene, this is like the late 70s, 78, 79, 80, the Boston scene was taken off. That's when the Cars were discovered. Mm-hmm. A lot of bands were being formed, like the Del Fuegos.
Right.
So a bunch of my friends ended up working with and knowing those guys, and I ended up sort of witnessing the scene. Now, the Cars became very famous. Mm-hmm. Aerosmith was already famous. There were various bands like Mission of Burma. The Del Fuegos became somewhat, you know, well-known. Mm-hmm. But there were a lot of bands that were supposed to be huge, and they ended up not being huge. Now, the ones I witnessed, because my friends were in them and I was backstage and I was at the gigs, it was the same old argument that almost every band has, which is the lead singer is the star. The lead guitar player hates the lead singer. The bass player hates them both because he gets no attention. And the drummer kind of hates everybody because he thinks the band's going to break up.
Right.
And they're all morons. Right.
All those are great. The drummer, I agree, is always underrated. He doesn't care about anybody. He's just banging the beat of his own drummer.
For years, I had that idea in my head. As we got older, some of these guys became terrifically successful musicians. But again, you wouldn't know who they are.
Right.
But like our tech advisor, the drum guy on the show, he's also the drummer in my band when I do live gigs. Right. Well, he's been a well-known musician. He plays multi-instrumental stuff.
Right.
He's been in Ozzy Osbourne's band. He's been on some of the greatest records ever known and made, and he's produced some of the – but you wouldn't know who he is because everybody he's involved with is the front man. So now he's a very happy guy, and that's he's very successful and happy to make a living doing it.
Right.
But there are certain other guys I know who are like, you know, we could have been huge if it was. It's always the lead singer. It's always the lead singer. And I thought, right, this is going to be really interesting to play a guy that didn't make it. And a couple of guys I knew in New York, talented guys, had basically gotten into their own way. And now when they were hitting 50, they were like blaming everybody else. That could have been us. Mm. You know, on the show, my character says Greg Dooley stole my vibe.
Right.
And Dave Grohl, you know, stole my essence. And like, it's all these guys from his generation.
Right.
And I met a few of those guys and I was like, this is an interesting character to play. Because what if this guy, this 50-year-old bitter guy, ended up discovering that he has a daughter who can sing.
Mm-hmm.
So once his daughter goes, Dad, I can sing and I want to be a rock and roll star.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like he's pimping his daughter, but he's not. He really loves her.
It's a shot at redemption.
It's a shot at redemption.
Right.
And now the whole struggle is about whether or not she's going to make it. And it's that mixture of pride and envy that he has in her.
Mm-hmm.
And this season, one of the things that happens is, you know, her mother was played by Callie Thorne. She came back at the end of last year and she had the reverse approach from my character, Johnny. She wanted to protect her daughter from being in the rock and roll business because she thought it was not worth it.
Right.
And so it's interesting because she comes back this year and she starts to share my point of view, which is like maybe we can make some money off of her. But it's what she wants to do.
Right.
You know, we're not forcing her to do it. So that's where it's a story about a big dysfunctional family. This is this band of guys and girls just can't get away from each other, you know?
It's a great show. Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. We didn't even talk about Ice Age, but my kids love Ice Age.
Ice Age 5.
Ice Age
July,
5.
I used to joke that there was going to be an Ice Age 5. Now there is one. July 22nd, I think, is the day for that.
But that's a cash cow. I mean, I'm sure it's a lot of fun, but it's also a gigantic hit. How could
I just,
you know?
I like, Ray, fun. I was with Ray Romano. Ray Romano was doing a concert. I do this benefit concert up in Boston every year for the Cam Neely Cancer Foundation.
Yep.
And Ray hadn't been there in a few years, and he was there this year. And it was right when the concert was on a Saturday night, and Ray was like, dude, can you believe we're doing Ice Age 5? And I said, what are we supposed to do? When they call up and say they want to make another one, they go, no.
Right.
You know what
we're
I mean?
Out. We think the story went as far as
I said, dude, we can get to Ice Age 9. It'll be like our great-grandchildren. You know what I mean? Who knows?
It's a legacy. I wish we could smoke some cigarettes right now and sing together. No Cure for Cancer. I still have the CD somewhere at home. If I had prepared, I would have had you sign it here for me, but that taught me who Sam Peckinpah was. Because there's the one scene you go, Lee Marvin and Sam Peckinpah.
Yeah.
And I go, who's this Sam Peckinpah? Oh, the Wild Bunch. This movie kicks ass.
Oh, right. Yeah, right. I forgot I called him out.
You help with like, film history for guys like
oh,
me.
Oh, my God.
Lee Marvin.
See, I'm not
blank.
Just a comedian. I'm a professor.
Professor Dennis Leary here on Cinephile, the Adnan Burke Movie Podcast. Thanks, man.
You're welcome.
Actors Showcase.
I love this. Stan's giving us the big one here. We're going to the Legends division. Normally gives me a few options. I think you threw out Hank Streep and Nicholson. So I think you're feeling like we got to go with a heavy hitter here.
I feel, yes, and I think we need to mix in a female eventually.
Yeah, I did notice that. We had that nice review here on Front Row for those that work at ESPN, and she was asking about my favorite actors, Shannon, and I went through all of them. She's like, how about some women? I'm like, you're right. It's a little too slanted with the De Niro, Pacino, DiCaprio. Okay, I got it.
A few weeks ago, I was pushing for Julia Roberts, and you mocked me. I just wanted a Pelican brief mention, and you couldn't even do it for me.
We're going to have Stanzik do Denzel Washington's Actor Showcase one day, because that is his favorite actor. Now, listen, I love Denzel Washington, obviously. Malcolm X, Glory, among my favorites. I do think he's made a lot of trash, and I think Stanzik once said he's never made a bad movie, which is what I...
Until I saw the movie Fallen, which is horrendous. My comment was always, I've never seen a bad Denzel movie. American Gangster wasn't good either.
Oh, he's had some dreckle. Deja Vu was bad. Virtuosity with Russell Crowe.
Let's move on.
All right, we'll slam Denzel another time. 5-1, and Stanzik has correctly pointed out, because the McConaughey was a miss. I was going with the best movies they've been in, but I think it's very tricky. This is their best performances. So Jack Nicholson's 5 best performances. We're going from 5-1. Number 5 will go The Few Good Men. Tim Kirchin, who shockingly has actually listened to this podcast before, if I don't put A Few Good Men in there, it's one of his favorite movies, he'll never speak to me again on Baseball Tonight. So number 5 is that. Simply for the fact, could you picture anybody else playing Colonel Nathan Jessup? And that's where I go, you know what, he embodies exactly what you'd expect, that type of authoritarian, take-no-prisoners, military guy in charge, and that whole courtroom scene. Sometimes scenes, I think, become overblown, and maybe in our memory they become bigger than they are. If you go back and watch that scene, it still has the same fireworks it did back then. You want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. Like, Aaron Sorkin is such a great writer, and Nicholson did an amazing job with that. I believe I read one or maybe two takes. I think it may have been one take, and Rob Reiner goes, all right, one more for coverage, but that was awesome, which never happens. For those who are unaware of filmmaking, 10 takes, 12 takes. Spielberg famously won't do more than 5. Eastwood will do 6 or 7. Marty will do 30, I mean, if you have to. I mean, some of these guys are nuts. David O. Russell one time did like 67 takes during Silver Linings Playbook. And Bradley Cooper's like, can I just get a gun next time along with the Oscar that I'm trying to win? All right, so number 5 there is A Few Good Men. Number 4 is As Good As It Gets. Nicholson was fantastic in this movie. Playing a guy who's suffering with OCD, and it's a really sweet film. It's him and Helen Hunt. Nicholson won his 3rd Oscar for it. Helen Hunt also won the Oscar for it. James L. Brooks wrote the script. Greg Kinnear is in the movie playing the next-door neighbor. And the greatness of Nicholson's performance is he plays a guy who's so unlikable. You know, he's homophobic, and he's racist, and he's a jerk, and he's a misanthropic guy who just suffers from this OCD and just wants to go get his pancakes and wants Helen Hunt to serve him, and the fork's got to be a certain way, and that's about it. And he hates Greg Kinnear's dog, and there's just not a lot to root with this guy. But yet he's this amazing writer of, like, romance novels, which is something you only see in the movies. I don't think a character like Nicholson in As Good As It Gets would have that much hate, and then apparently he's this great romance novelist. But I'll forgive the film that issue because he's so funny in the movie, and especially the way that he plays such a likable cad. I mean, the way that he's just so mean-spirited to Greg Kinnear, and yet he becomes endearing is part of Nicholson's gift.
I think my favorite line in film is in that movie. One of the characters asks him, how do you write women so well?
I think of a man.
And take away reason and accountability.
I mean, that is Jack Nicholson, like a likable cad if there ever was one. There's a ton of great lines like that. Stanzik's right. There's a really sweet scene, too. You know, after he's going to go get a sports coat in this restaurant, he's trying to finally impress Helen Hunt. And he goes in there and he tells his story. And he goes, I hate pills. Hate. I'm using the word hate about pills. He goes, the day after you came to my house and whatever. She's like, I know. She showed up and she was like, I'm never going to sleep with you. And then he says, I started taking the pills. And she goes, I really don't get how that's a compliment for me. And he plays the scene beautifully. He kind of looks down and he goes, you make me want to be a better man. And she says, that might be the nicest compliment of my life. And he goes, well, maybe I overshot a little, but I was aiming it just enough to make sure you wouldn't go out. It's a really great scene. Make sure you watch As Good As It Gets. That's number 4 on our list of the top Nicholson movies. Number 3 is About Schmidt. Alexander Payne, one of the great directors out there, when he cast Jack Nicholson, they started going through some scenes, and Nicholson was kind of hamming it up. And Alexander Payne pulled him aside, and he goes, listen, this isn't really working so far. And Jack's like, what do you mean? He goes, well, the way you're playing this, like, he's this old widower. Like, he's a very sad, depressed guy who can't deal with the fact that his daughter's getting married and, his wife has passed away, and you got to play it straight. Like, there's humor in there with all of Alexander Payne's films, like Sideways and Nebraska. They're funny, but they're awfully sad as well. And Nicholson paused and smiled and goes, oh, you actually want me to act? Well, I haven't done that in a long time. He's just been playing this archetype of Jack Nicholson for so long, these wild over-the-top guys. He's like, oh, I can do that. Sorry, I just got to brush it off. The cobwebs are a little overwhelming here. And then in About Schmidt, he gives a subtle, nuanced performance of a guy who's dealing with the death of his wife, but then finds out she was cheating on him. So he's completely furious with his dead wife. He goes after his best friend, who's the one who had the affair. The daughter's getting married to this absolute loser. He's like, God, he's so depressed. And there's this hilarious subplot of Dear and Dugu, because he's writing this African child that he is giving money to, and he figures it's the one good thing I can do here is send money to this kid. He sends these incredible letters to Ndugu. That it's like this kid is like 7 years old living in an impoverished country, and he's like writing about his life and his emotions, and it's so absurd and yet so funny. The ending, one of the great endings ever of a Jack Nicholson movie for sure, and of the last 25 years, this guy's so depressed, he's so down. That ending of that movie, Alexander Payne's got a gift for great endings, and that definitely is one of them. Number 2, we'll go with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Iconic. I mean, again, you can't picture anybody else but Nicholson in that movie. Have you read the Ken Kesey book, by the way, Stanzik? No, I hear it's an excellent book, but a rarity for some I've talked to. They say the movie's actually better than the book. The book is, a little bit intense, and it goes very much into detail about what life is like in the mental hospital. But Milos Forman did an incredible job with the film. Of course, you got Nurse Ratched in there. She's awfully despicable. But Danny DeVito in the movie as well. But Nicholson really has that anarchistic, rebellious spirit. Let's take no prisoners. Let's get out of this stuff. And it ends up being really heartbreaking what happens to his character as he's trying to lead all these guys in their revolution. And number 1 is Chinatown, one of the best film noirs of all time. Polanski, such a great director. He's never done a better film than that. Nicholson as J.J. Giddies is trying to get to the bottom of the truth. And it's if you're a screenwriter, an aspiring writer,
Watch Chinatown, because that Robert Towne script is one of the all-time best. If you ever go to any sort of screenwriting class or you talk to people in the writing, they'll say, oh, my goodness, that Robert Towne script, the way that's plotted and the characters, and it's a film noir and a mystery, and you got the femme fatale, and you got a private eye, and his nose gets cut up by Polanski in a cameo. But what's it about? It's about water. It's about drought. It's about the most simple thing. It's set in California in the 40s. Absolute masterpiece. There's a couple of stunning scenes in there that if you've never seen it, you're absolutely blown away by. So those are the five best films of Jack Nicholson. Number one is Chinatown. Number two is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Number three is About Schmidt. Number four is As Good As It Gets. Number five is A Few Good Men. Missing the cut. Go ahead, tweet us. At AdnanESPN. Tell me what an idiot I am. I left off The Shining, Terms of Endearment, The Departed, Prizzy's Honor, and plenty more, including The Bucket List.
Actors in three words.
Once again, Stanzik, very smart move. We went from 10 to 5. The buzz is building. People love three words. Mark Simon, who's won the Baseball Tonight, researchers for a long time now. He's just has some role in the research department. He's like a senior researcher. I don't know his exact title. He just wrote a Yankees book. He's now using three words all the time. Like he went and saw a Nationals game, and he tweets, hey, here's my three words in honor of Adnan Burke. So people are loving it. It's become America's favorite game. Three words. Give us the actors.
It was very controversial at first, and now I'm glad America's on board. That's great.
It's back.
We're going heavy hitters again. Tom Hanks.
First one is Jimmy Stewart, because he's a modern-day Jimmy Stewart. Another word would be everyman. He's that guy that is always the quintessential everyman. He is the one that represents America for our times. There's nobody better than you picture in that role. Along with that, decency is always the word of Tom Hanks. You don't really picture him as a vile guy. He's always a decent, noble character who wants to do the good thing. But having said that, the third word is safe. I think too many of his choices sometimes are a little bit too, to borrow the McConaughey phrase again, drenched in nobility. I'd like to see him take some chances once in a while. Even though I wasn't a huge Training Day fan, and Denzel certainly should have won an Oscar for it, I like the fact he got down and dirty and played a criminal. I love Morgan Freeman in his first major films, a movie called Street Smart, playing a badass. I wish Hanks once in a while, when I heard he was doing Road to Perdition, like he's playing a gangster, I'm like, all right, good. Hanks, a little more foul mouth, tough, edgy. It's like, no. Again, he's just a sweet, decent gangster trying to take care of his kids. It's not that he isn't a great actor, but I think he's a little safe for those roles.
He's safe in 2016, but he did Philadelphia and Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump, I don't think was risky. Philadelphia was risky for its time, because you're right. AIDS, a subject matter, doing something like that head on. Forrest Gump, that was telegraphed for Academy Award success. You just listen, to borrow the Robert Downey Jr. phrase from Tropic Thunder, if you always play a half retard, you'll be fine. That's his quote, not mine.
Anna Kendrick.
Anna Kendrick, going to go with perky. The first thing you picture is her just all bubbly and perky and stuff. Singer. Didn't know she actually sings as well, so she's got some talent. The third word is limited. I don't know how much Anna Kendrick is bringing to the table beyond being perky, a singer, and limited.
Did you see the movie Up in the Air?
Up in the Air, she's great. I was going to say, that's the only great film I'd say she's done. I'm not familiar with the filmography of Pitch Perfect.
Your loss. All right, Mark Ruffalo.
You'll love this one. Idiosyncratic. I mean, you look at Ruffalo, and he's always got like these little kind of tics and idiosyncrasies. And he is so much fun to watch in the movie Spotlight, which is a very heavy watch and a great drama. And if you haven't seen it, go watch it. Deserve a best picture. But he's always got something going on. I love that about him. I just think he's got all these kind of quirks. And I don't know if he's like that in person. I've seen him, on talk shows. Not that that's a real reflection of what somebody's like. But he seems a little less like that. But I think he's got those idiosyncrasies. He's always kind of scruffy, which I like. Even when he was in The Hulk, he's always kind of just looking like a bit of a mess. And the third word is mumbler. His really good film that really kind of put him on the map was You Can Count on Me, Kenneth Lonergan's film with Laura Linney. And some of the reviews said he was like a modern-day Brando. And I'm like, oh, my God, you're calling a new actor and a modern-day Brando the greatest actor of all time? But they're referring to the fact he's always kind of mumbling in his movies. It's just kind of an odd thing about him. Idiosyncratic, scruffy, and a mumbler.
Melissa McCarthy.
Well, she's bombastic. I mean, she's definitely over the top and loud and having a good time. And I guess for some people that's pretty funny. And listen. Bridesmaids, she's very funny. And certainly the scene in the sink there, pretty good. So bombastic is one. The second word, though, I think is more appropriate. It's tired. Like, I got it. You're just loud and overweight. And
I was thinking typecast.
Yeah, typecast. Let's replace that. Bombastic and typecast. The third one, though, I'm going to go with is rich. Because not only has she made these movies, which have actually done a ton of money, and she's got some of the box office gross, she's got a hit TV show as well. So Melissa McCarthy, for someone who I don't think does a whole lot beyond being typecast, she's also filthy rich.
Surprised you didn't say round. Lastly, we'll do Michael Keaton.
When she sits around the house, she sits around the house. Michael Keaton's three words. The first one is comeback. My guy's back. I mean, Michael Keaton was such a good actor for so long, and then you see him like pop up in Jackie Brown, and you go, okay, Michael Keaton's in this. Then there's like a decade of nothing. He's in a movie called Game 6. Stanzik is a baseball guy. You'll like this one. It's based in a play, and it's about a guy who's a diehard Red Sox fan. He's a playwright. He's got a play opening, and he's all fretful because of what's happening with the World Series. There's parallels here with Birdman. Everyone kept talking about Birdman, the fact that it's about a washed-up actor trying to get a comeback with a, you know, independent film that means a lot to him. In the movie, obviously, independent play, but famous for playing a superhero. That was Batman. Now he's playing Birdman. But Game 6 is also along those lines of a guy who's trying to rekindle his lost magic. It's actually not a bad movie, but my point is he was off the radar. Nobody knew what the hell Michael Keaton was up to, and then he goes roaring back to life with Birdman.
You don't have to do it now, but at some point in this podcast, can you explain the ending of Birdman to me?
Oh. So I'll do it now. I said I thought the movie had third act issues. And Ryan Russillo, one of our friends, of course, does a great job. We're going to get him a Cinephile at some point. He's eager to get on, although I don't think he's listened to a full episode.
Get in line, Russillo.
Yeah, we got a lot of good heavy hitters here. Dennis Leary was huge. He goes, I don't think they had third act issues. I think you're being hard on it. I think it had like 3 minute issues. Like, the last 3 minutes isn't good. I said, no, he should have killed himself on stage. Now, I know that wouldn't happen ever in a film. But listen, I get with the fact with major big market, you know, studio movies go, we can't do that. But this was an indie movie. Alejandro Gonzalez Iñárritu, the director's taking chances. Like, be bold. Like, God, it's all about magic realism. The guy walks around his underwear in Times Square. He should kill himself on that stage. It'd be dark.
Perfect
It'd
ending.
Be great. Black Swan, Aronofsky, gutsy ending. She kills herself at the end. I'm like, oh, my God. Like, this is the movie you're going for. Then why? He actually ends up being a bird. Because he looks in the mirror and his nose is like a beak. And when he jumps out the window and his daughter sees him, you see her look up for a second like he's flying. And then she kind of looks down. So you can either say he jumped to his death, which I don't think is the case. I think because the movie dips into a lot of magic realism, Michael Keaton at the end has actually morphed and become Birdman.
I wish I didn't ask.
Third word is eyebrows. He's got the best eyebrows along with Nicholson. He's always got the arched eyebrows working all the time. Michael Keaton, we love him. Those are the three words. Comeback, Birdman, and eyebrows.
Streaming suggestions.
All right, on Netflix, check out Back to the Future. I think it's nothing less than the greatest family film of all time. I mean, The Enchantment of the Sea Dance, Michael J. Fox, I'm Late for School. Christopher Lloyd should have been nominated for an Oscar. He's so great as Dr. Emmett Brown. 1.21 gigawatts! There's so many funny lines in that movie, and yet it's got a lot of heart. You know, it's a really sweet story about trying to connect your parents back together. Earth Angel, Crispin Glover. There's a lot to love about Back to the Future. I'm sure you've seen it, but go watch it again. It's on Netflix. Also, Insomnia is a movie that I love. Al Pacino. I can't wait to do the Actors Showcase Pacino. It would be impossible to do only five. But Insomnia, for all those that rip him, and I get the fact the last decade and a half has been rather lean for Al, the last great performance I'd say he's given was Insomnia in 2002. Lisa Schwartzbaum, who's a former great critic for Entertainment Weekly, said something like he's been sleepwalking through a lot of his roles, but Insomnia, Pacino, the great actor, is wide awake. It was a great line. He's so rooted in the reality of a fact of a guy who can't sleep. If you haven't seen it, he's in Nightmute, Alaska. He's a cop who's investigating a murder, and he's got a backstory of where he's a little shady, trying to bury some evidence. So that's weighing on him. And the collection of the fact that there's this guilt and concern and paranoia in his mind, and the fact that there is never darkness there. We're taking a trip one day, me and you. I would love to go to a place just because it's so freaky. It's never dark. And so he can't get a nap in. He can't get any sort of sleep. There's no rest from this situation. There's no respite from the fact that his mind is working overdrive and the fact that he could be going to prison for tampering evidence and the fact that he's trying to find this killer who's played by Robin Williams, one of his best performances. The beauty of this is Pacino sometimes can be, you know, a little bit too robust. Here, he's just kind of weighed down, and you can feel the gravity of the situation. Robin Williams, at times, who can be rather excessive and hyperactive, is very still and very calm. And he said that. He goes, when I was playing a killer, I didn't want to be one of these killers who was very showy. I wanted to just show how calm he was about the fact that he's just, you know, butchering these women. Hilary Swank's also in the movie, Academy Award winner. She's very good as somebody who looks up to Pacino. And Christopher Nolan, great director. We know him and love him for a lot of his films, like Memento, going way back to that. And, of course, his major films, like the Dark Knight trilogy. But there's a great scene on the floating logs, actually. It's a great chase sequence where Pacino's chasing Robin Williams. And it shows that Christopher Nolan can not only have really emotional and thinking films, like Interstellar, but also have a great chase sequence, which he shows in Insomnia. The third movie to recommend is The Lovely Bones. Now, this was a misfire because the book is beloved. Peter Jackson did the movie, and it got tepid reviews.
Box office was disappointing, and I thought the movie was all right. Again, I hadn't read the book, so I had no reference point. But Stanley Tucci is great in it. You talk about underrated actors. He's one of those guys I love, like Giamatti and William H. Macy and Mark Ruffalo. Like, Tucci's one of those guys. When he's in the movie, when he was in the Spotlight, I go, oh, here we go. Like, Tucci's in the movie, perfect. This is already going to be great. He's got a great scene in Spotlight when he says to Ruffalo, he goes, what are you, Armenian? Or, no, what are you, Italian? Ruffalo goes, no, I'm Portuguese. He goes, I'm Armenian. They don't want us here. We got another Armenian at the Boston Globe, Steve Kirchin, who is Tim Kirchin's cousin. Tucci plays the killer in this movie. I disagree. Ty Burr's a great film critic. He writes for the Boston Globe. He said The Lovely Bones is an example of a very good actor in Stanley Tucci giving a very bad performance, which I disagree. Tucci was nominated for an Oscar. His point was that he thought Tucci was too mannered and too effective, and he's got that terrible comb-over and the way he's mumbling at times. He goes after, hey, you're that salmon girl, right? He thought it was too much. I thought he was great. I thought he was riveting and stone cold, and so Lovely Bones is an option as well. On Hulu, The Aviator, of course, we love Marty. Scorsese's story is coming up momentarily. A great film. For those that criticize it sometimes and say, all right, too many gangster movies, too many crime films. Well, there's none of that in The Aviator. It is an old-school Hollywood epic. It's about Howard Hughes who dared to dream. And later the film focuses on the OCD and just how strange and unhinged this guy was. But the movie really shows filmmaking. That shows the beauty of aviation. And when it crashes, it plummets. That scene where DiCaprio crashes is just incredible filmmaking. Leo's in it, obviously. But Cate Blanchett also won an Oscar for it. Really good cast, including Alan Alda as the villain in that. Glory, you know, Free State of Jones was such a disappointing Civil War movie. The best Civil War movie for me is Glory. Denzel Washington, never been better. Amazing, just so much resolve and those steely eyes and so much fire in there as this former slave who's now fighting for the Union Army. Morgan Freeman has a lot of gravitas in the film. Andre Brower, who I love, he plays this guy Thomas, who's very much an intellectual, and he kind of talks very properly, and he kind of gets... You know, he gets a hard time there from Denzel and the other guys. They think, oh, you know, you're black, but you're not really black because you're proper and you went to a good school. And he plays it amazing because he's trying to do the right thing here and fight for the union and fight for black people's freedom. And yet he's not really welcome by the guys that he's fighting with. Matthew Broderick plays the colonel in charge of them. Little quibble with him. I don't think he's great in the movie. He was really miscast at the time. You go, Matthew Broderick's really young to play this guy. But I'm sure the real life story is amazing too. One of the best soundtracks ever. People ask me about great movie music. James Horner, the soundtrack for Glory is as good as it gets. Horner passed away last year. And people said, oh, he's the Titanic composer. I don't know. He's the Glory composer. Go listen to that music. I believe it's the Boys of Harlem, the Choir Boys of Harlem. It's an incredible soundtrack. So Glory, directed by Ed Zwick. And also Trainspotting. That's a drug movie from Danny Boyle. It's funny. It's entertaining. The first 10 minutes of Trainspotting are fantastic. I mean, it's just you and McGregor running. You've got Iggy Pop, Lust for Life. You know, it's a bunch of these druggy lowlifes in England. And then obviously the second half kind of shows the harrowing descent. There's one scene where he goes into a toilet bowl. I mean, there's some wild stuff in there. Danny Boyle really pushes the envelope. Later won an Oscar for Slumdog Millionaire, which won Best Picture. But Trainspotting is an early film from him. If you like British crime films and that kind of gritty style, you'll like Trainspotting. Last three for you, Amazon Prime, Best in Show. Somebody tweeted the other day, what's the best Christopher Guest movie aside from Spinal Tap? I would say Best in Show, primarily just for Fred Willard. I mean, he's sending up Joe Garagiola there with how ridiculous these dog announcers are. It is so funny. And the guy, I don't know his name, the actor who's with him, the English guy, is so good because he's playing it straight. He's like, that's a Shih Tzu. And Willard's like, wait, what's that? Hey, a Shih Tzu. Oh, my God, that must be kind of fun. And there's one dog who's like, I think they should put like a hat on him, like a Sherlock Holmes hat and a pipe. I think that may be pretty good. And, of course, at one point, famously, he says to the guy, he goes, how much do you think I can bench? He's like, what? He goes, seriously, how much do you think I can bench? He's just so ridiculous in that movie. Whole cast. Eugene Levy has two left feet. At one point, he has to come out with the dog. And they go, is that guy got two left feet over there? Really funny movie. Casino, I don't love it as much as, you know, other Scorsese diehards do. The first half of it's incredible because it feels like a documentary. You know, De Niro, a lot of voiceover work. He's explaining the way Vegas is set up and the way gambling is set up. The second half, I hate to say, I felt a little repetitive considering Goodfellas came out in 1990. Casino came out in 95. All right, Pesci's always entertaining and funny, but he's another psychotic guy. You know, De Niro's trying to keep it all together. Sharon Stone's over the top and was nominated for an Oscar, arguably never been better. But I thought the second half kind of felt a little more predictable. But the first half, I really enjoyed at Casino. And if you like gambling movies, and obviously if you like Marty Mobb movies, the scene with Frank Vincent getting his comeuppance against Pesci is a really good one. And lastly, The Shining. That wasn't one of the five films that me and Stanzik put in there for Nicholson, the Actors Showcase, but really creepy film. Kubrick, when it comes to like atmospheric style and that cold, clinical feeling you get when watching his movies, The Shining is a great one. Horror film, Red Rum, scene with Nicholson and the bartender, Here's Johnny. so much memorable about The Shining. So check it out on Amazon Prime.
A Scorsese story.
We never actually checked the tape, Stanzik. Last time, did I say I was going to tell a Raging Bull story and then told a Goodfellas story, or was that you just guessing?
No, that's exactly what happened.
Okay, so I'll tell a Raging Bull story this time. Correct that. Brawl has been waiting a couple weeks. So Scorsese doesn't like sports at all, which people always say, what if you met him one day? I'm like, well, I wouldn't mention the fact I'm a sportscaster, because he has said famously, I hate sports. I have no interest in it. He grew up with asthma in Little Italy. You always see in his movies, there's this recurring theme of a kid looking outside. In Goodfellas, you see that as a kid who's looking out, watching all the gangsters on the stoop, and that's what Marty used to do. In the film Hugo, which I love, there's a scene of the kid in the train station. He's always watching the kids from upstairs, and that's who Marty was as a kid. He was always upstairs because he was so sick, and you know, he's asthmatic. He's just always watching, observing, and I'm watching a ton of movies because his dad would always take him to the movies, and that's what I think what really shaped him in his mind. He was always so observant. So in Raging Bull, De Niro comes to him and goes, listen, we got to make this movie. And he goes, listen, I hate sports. Like, I know nothing about boxing. There's nothing interesting here. And De Niro really wanted to make it. He goes, no, I'm telling you, this is the kind of film we have to make. It's so important that we do this. And it was based on a book, Jake LaMotta's book, and he just goes, I don't get it. Now, Scorsese was going through a really difficult time, divorce, cocaine abuse, ended up being in the hospital. And he, in his own words, because I nearly died. Like, it was awful how bad it was. And I was absolutely exhausted. I was absolutely spent. I was just so focused on my work, and my life was spinning out of control. And it was at that point that I realized I could make the film of Jake LaMotta. And De Niro came to the hospital again. He's like, listen, we got to make this. And I said, okay, you know what? Now I can do it. Because I couldn't understand the hook of boxing and why someone would want to be a boxer. But I understood the hook of self-destructiveness. And I'd been through that myself now. And I got the fact that Jake LaMotta has the sadomasochistic behavior, and his self-esteem is so low. Stanzik can help me with this. They say in Catholicism, kind of like the Madonna horror complex, that he feels like he hates himself so much that the only person that can be with him is either a Madonna or a whore. And I guess that's what Scorsese kind of relied on for that. And he goes, that's where we kind of came out with the De Niro character. He goes that, you know, he hates himself so much, and he feels that he should be punished. And again, this goes with Marty's very Catholic views of salvation and sin and redemption. So essentially, because he has so much guilt, he goes in the ring and he wants to be beaten up for his sins and what a horrible person he is. And that's how he tries to find salvation and find redemption as well. But it's an incredible movie, and it's a really good reminder of how sometimes you're not sure what you want until it takes a little bit of time to circle back and figure it out. And I think if Scorsese just had kept saying no to Raging Bull, he wouldn't have made one of the greatest films of all time. And that's not just me. You ask anybody who loves movies. I believe AFI, the American Film Institute, has one of the top 10 films of all time. Sight and Sound, which is a very prestigious film magazine. Every 10 years, they do the top movies of all time, and Raging Bull always ranks in the top 10, along with Citizen Kane and Casablanca and Goodfellas and all those major films. So Raging Bull. It took a while for Marty to figure out why he had to make it, but once he did, it's an incredible movie. So thanks so much for listening to Cinephile. On a somber note, a couple of passings here from the film world. Michael Cimino, the director, died. He made the film The Deer Hunter, which is a great movie about Vietnam. That scene, the Russian roulette scene with Christopher Walken and the Deer Hunter, go ahead and YouTube that. It's an amazing scene. Cimino, unfortunately, made also a film called Heaven's Gate, which is one of the biggest bombs in film history. So it always goes intertwined. And unfortunately, when he passed away, everyone goes, oh, the director of the Deer Hunter won an Oscar and also made Heaven's Gate, which was a colossal misfire. But go back and watch the Deer Hunter, because De Niro, Christopher Walken, a really special film. Meryl Streep, John Cazale—that's where they met on that film as well. And also Abbas Kiarostami, who's an Iranian filmmaker. Scorsese, a huge fan of his, in fact, wrote an appreciation for him in Variety and The Hollywood Reporter. He just passed away as well. He won the Palme d'Or for a film called Taste of Cherry, which was actually banned in Iran because they thought that the film was promoting suicide. And Kiarostami said, no, it's actually an appreciation for life. It's about a man in Tehran who is looking for somebody to help bury him once he kills himself. And Kiarostami said, no, the film is dark and serious, but ultimately it's trying to be life-affirming. Also a film called Where's the Friend's Home? The Wind Will Carry Us. Kiarostami is one of those filmmakers. If you love world cinema and foreign films, and particularly he was at the forefront of the Iranian New Wave in the late 90s, those films really started to get traction here stateside. So check out his films. It's a real loss for the film world. He was a really, really great director. Also did a movie called Certified Copy with Juliette Binoche. So he did have some films with English-speaking as well. All right, that'll do it for us. So for my producer, Dan Stanzik, I'm Adnan Verk. Thanks for listening to Cinephile, and I'll see you at the movies.
Don't miss out on the next episode of Cinephile. Subscribe to the Adnan Verk Movie Podcast by clicking the Listen tab in the ESPN app.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, the trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.